Mystery Crate has been presented by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hello, Craters. Welcome back. This is episode, what episode is this?
Not sure. Hang on. I gotta pull it up.
Episode number 17.
Sugats is always good about
Mystery Crate.
Well, he's terrible at counting the numbers on stupidity.
That's because I did, I think we're at 30. We're supposed to be at 31. I took a week off. Stanzik was supposed to do it. He didn't do it, and I fired him.
So I haven't been paid?
Stanzik or me?
You.
I have not been paid yet.
So this is the last week of Stupidity.
Telling you, this is it. This is the last week of Stupidity. If I don't get paid at some point in the next 7 days, I am no longer doing Stupidity.
All right, so I believe this is episode 17.
That is exactly what I said.
Good guess.
God, I'm so good at guess. Yeah. I knew that. I wasn't guessing. Yeah. I knew that.
Great in it.
Episode 17 of the Mystery Crate. We were off last week because of the holiday and the hurricane that was threatening parts of Florida. So we are back. And if you listen to the daily radio show, you'd know that Greg Cody's birthday was this week.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Fanfare?
The big 6'5", right?
Yeah. Big 6'5". He's now eligible for all sorts of benefits, right? He's like, right? How's your dad acting now that he's 65? Is this some sort of benchmark for him? My dad was super happy to hit 65, even though it's a large number. He's incredibly fit for his age, but he's like, now I can start getting some free stuff and discounts.
Yeah.
He seems the same to me, but I have noticed because he's been doing these Instagram lives lately,
right?
Where he seems to be talking more out of the side of his mouth now. I don't know if that's something to be alarmed by in general or whether it's just him getting old. Hmm. I think it's just his face is becoming old.
What do you think is the best perk of being 65? Like the best thing that you'd get for free or like discounted?
Well, don't you get Social Security? I mean, that's...
You have early access to it, although nowadays most people don't take it unless they're in tougher spots.
Right.
This is a weird thing.
Medicare?
Medicare is pretty good.
Some people don't even like the benefits of like being a senior citizen. My father-in-law like refuses to get the senior breakfast at places because he doesn't want to think of himself like that.
Same with my dad. Will not take them. Refuses to take them because my dad's still working and he's 77 years old and he's still working. So he just doesn't want to feel old, you know?
Yeah, my dad couldn't say yes quick enough to any of these discounts. And quite frankly, he's been taking them a lot earlier than he should have been. I remember him taking me to the movie theaters when I was 14, trying to convince people that I was 6. I had to go up to the counter and pretend I was a lot shorter.
You sure he's not my dad?
Hey, so it's Greg's birthday this week, as we just mentioned, so I'm giving the Mystery Crate audience a special loaded Greg Cody-themed episode.
Wow.
Yes, we have an edition of You Never Know coming up at the end of this episode. But Greg and Dan did an interview with Albert Chen, who wrote the book Billion Dollar Fantasy, the high-stakes game between FanDuel and DraftKings that upended sports in America. It's a fascinating conversation. You saw all these commercials for Daily Fantasy a couple of years ago. It totally saturated the market, and it became a real arms race between two big-time companies. So Albert Chen stops by the Mystery Crate, talks to Dan and Stu about this interesting thing. But first...
Dan and Greg.
Oh, yes. Right. Dan and Greg.
Yes.
Sorry.
I'm doing Stupidity, and I'm having a magician on.
The Stupidity's out now. Sell your magician interview.
I have a magician that comes on. I desperately wanted him on. He's a magician to the stars. Stanzik told me it was a bad idea. Find out who was right. Okay? Magician was great.
Yeah?
Yeah, and then I had Andrew... Speaking of magicians... Andrew Siciliano.
That's a bigger magician.
I mean, that guy. And he invited all of us, by the way. He invited all of us to the Red Zone Studios out in L.A.
Wow.
The entire show.
All right, let's roll.
He looks like he'd be a magician.
He's got big ears.
Doesn't he? I feel like he looks like a magician.
Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe El Toro COO Dylan Maskowitz needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. I love that title, a director of coffee. But he was having trouble finding qualified applicants, so he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get a qualified candidate fast. Dylan posted the job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, It's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/crate. That's ZipRecruiter.com/crate. C-R-A-T-E. ZipRecruiter.com/crate. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Man, I read that well. It's not always that I get that in one take.
Who's our director of coffee?
Ooh, people?
Yeah, people for sure.
People or whatever, but whatever wants okay. here.
Yeah, right.
Law makes it best. Kind
of scene. It is a great title, Director of Coffee.
Yeah, I'd imagine a coffee company needs one of those. So here it is, Albertson joining Dan and Greg to talk about the duel between FanDuel and DraftKings and Daily Fantasy, how the business started, where the business is now, where it goes in the future. It's a really fascinating conversation with Albertson. Here it is.
You guys know that Greg Cody is an incredible fantasy dork. I have no interest in any of this stuff as it relates to Sundays, but I do have an interest in the business of fantasy. I think at this point it might be bigger than the business of fantasy that is porn in terms of dollars. I'm not totally sure, but Albert Chen has written a new book, Billion Dollar Fantasy. It is available today. And basically what he's looking at, all of us were weirded out. We didn't really understand it. Gambling sort of became legal all of a sudden with DraftKings and FanDuel. We're standing around and then, wait a minute, this is allowed? All of this is allowed? And so I was interested in the business of this, and Albert Chen has written an entire book about the business. So, Albert, thank you very much for joining us. And my first question would be, what led you to this project? Like, how did you end up, instead of writing an article about this for Sports Illustrated, where you work, writing an entire book?
Well, I think it began really in the climax of the story is 2015, as you mentioned. I mean, this is a football season where, you know, Trevor Noah's quip then is, you know, you can't turn on a TV without seeing a zombie, a Kardashian, or a fantasy football ad. I mean, these two companies, DraftKings and FanDuel, for a stretch in September of 2015, were the two biggest advertisers in America. So as a story, I mean, it's obvious that this is an incredible story. And to me, what I was drawn to was how these companies got started, really almost by accident. Two founders who were kind of in over their heads for different reasons. And then here they are, 2015, in the middle of this just absolutely insane advertising war.
Well, explain to us how they were in over their heads, each of them differently.
Well, it was kind of a classic story of a startup, but with this backdrop where kind of, you know, this entire industry is really at stake here. And so you got five Brits working out of a converted classroom in Scotland, pivoting from a news prediction site to something weird called fantasy sports. And they look at the numbers and they're like, wow, this is a massive industry. And then they look at the innovation and there's like no innovation whatsoever. I mean, we're just, you know, still drafting teams like we did, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so they create a game, and it kind of takes fire in its own way. And then in 2012, 3 years after FanDuel's founded, you got these Boston guys who have never started a business before. But you know what? Their strategy is, we're just going to try to raise as much money as possible and burn through it all, and that's exactly what they did.
What kind of mistakes did both sides make?
Well, you know, it was all in the name of brand awareness, where they were appearing on TV every 90 seconds during the heat of football season 2015. So they were just in this war to, you know, it was first to survive, then it was to win this market where all this money was gushing in, and they wanted to get on everyone's living rooms, and that's what they did. Unfortunately, they didn't think about the consequences of that or even the quality of the commercials. And what you had was the media, you, regulators, everyone saying, what the hell is this? This looks like gambling, and why am I watching these commercials every 90 seconds?
His new book, Billion Dollar Fantasy, is available today. Sports Illustrated's Albert Chen joins us.
Albert, being old and old school, I'm in a couple of leagues. I find it sort of exhausting just to do the regular lineups once a week. Why do you think that this took off like it did? What is the appetite for the daily idea of fantasy football?
Well, I think there are two realities here. I mean, you know, why did it take off? Well, it didn't, I mean, it took off for sure with customers, but it didn't take off and become this massive thing that either of the companies were doing. It took off in the eyes of investors who saw the potential in fantasy sports, and suddenly now you can have a quicker thing that, you know, honestly, you know, the fantasy leagues that you and I are in and have been in for a long time, they really have no relation to what these two companies were providing here with their games. And so investors just put in a ton of money into this, hoping that this would actually hit on an industry where there's been no innovation. Again, we're doing live drafts as if it's 1983 with our buddies, you know, at a sports bar. And it's, so they thought that these two products could be sort of the way into a world here and now in 2019 where fantasy sports and gambling, I mean, it's all kind of a gray area where it's sort of one in the same, and you can do it on your phone now.
So they end up seeing both sides a market inefficiency. How do they go about getting the investors to exploit it?
Again, you know, I think it's a classic startup story where you walk into a room and you tell a story and invest, you know, if you do that at the right place, right time, and they did in, you know, 2012, 2013, where there's just a ton of venture capital money just, you know, waiting to be spent. And look, the sports industry, I mean, it's changed just remarkably over the last 5 years since then. And I think it was kind of this understanding from investor side. And it was, look, this was also getting the leagues on board, too. They have equity stake in these companies. And it's just presenting the story of just like, look, 60 million fantasy football players, you know, this is the way we're going to engage fans going forward when people are just consuming sports differently. And so, yeah, we're going to sign up and see where this goes. And it was a huge bet because of just the amount of money that was spent. But actually, now that we're getting to this time where gambling is becoming mainstream, FanDuel and DraftKings are looking pretty good moving forward.
Well, explain to us the dollars of this. FanDuel and DraftKings bought in using how much money? How much money have they lost to date? And where have they made money? Where do they see progress?
Well, to answer your last question first, I mean, it's all about this gambling market. But up until this point, or, you know, maybe a year and a half ago where it was questionable whether we were going to have mainstream gambling eventually across the country, they were a classic startup that raised a ton of money. And what we're talking about in terms of DraftKings, you know, close between $800 and $900 million. And FanDuel has raised at this point over $400 million. And, you know, they both got billion-dollar valuations in the summer of 2015. Customer-wise, you know, the daily product, it's 10 million customers, but how many of those customers are actually playing? But they've moved on from that. You know, 10% of DraftKings' business in New Jersey is daily fantasy because, you know what, the other 50% and is a big chunk of it is now in gambling, where I can cross the GW Bridge here in New York and put money down on, you know, the slate of baseball games on my phone. And that's what the numbers are all about now going forward, and we have no idea how big those numbers are going to get.
When did both sides, FanDuel and DraftKings, realize they had something? How fast did they realize that they had sort of, you know, broken the internet?
Well, you know, I think that it was really all about this investor money where they kind of thought that they had something. I mean, you know, we can get into the weeds of the stories of both companies, but the bottom line is they just spent years and years and years, and it just was not happening. And then in 2014, it was like a huge push on FanDuel's part to do this ad campaign, and they just got a ton of customers by their standards that football season. And it was fall of 2014, and that's when you saw the ads. And a big moment here is when Adam Silver and the NBA decided, okay, we're going to partner up with FanDuel. And that was the fall of 2014. And that's when a league was the first league kind of out there to say, we're on board with this. We're going to see where this takes us. And as you know, Adam Silver has been, you know, at the front of this where he's, you know, more or less supported legalized gambling across America.
His new book, Billion Dollar Fantasy, is available today. Albert Chen with us.
Albert, of course, there was a time when it seemed like this whole thing might collapse. When the Justice Department got involved, when it was deemed illegal, an illegal gambling operation by at least a half dozen states, what did it take to turn that around and have this whole thing green-lighted? Was it the NFL and NBA getting
on
board?
And how scared were they during that time?
Right.
Oh, I mean, during that period, they were terrified. I mean, you had executives kind of just ask around, I mean, saying that they had a great run and, you know, for a number of different reasons. I mean, PayPal doesn't want to deal with them because they're in the news for bad headlines. We're going to pull the plug. If that happens, it's game over. And look, they were shut down in New York for a stretch of time. So, there were people at definitely FanDuel and DraftKings who thought it was game over potentially if one bill doesn't get passed in Albany in the fall of 2016. And, you know, it was passed, but it was kind of an 11th hour deal that was honestly 50-50. So these two companies, I mean, there are a good number of people who are surprised that they're frankly just still around. And so what really had their backs was it was all about the leagues at this point, you know. And one of the CEOs said, look, we partnered up with all these professional teams. I mean, the Jaguars have FanDuelville, you know, where you can hang out and play, you know, on FanDuel's daily product. And if they don't have the support of the leagues in the fall of 2015, because these guys are just all in at this point, then they're done. But it was having Adam Silver and, you know, the NFL teams that they had partnered with who had their backs, and that's really what saved them at the end of the day.
So if the NFL and the NBA aggressively resist this, it doesn't exist today.
Right. I mean, I think these companies are in big trouble. I think, look, daily fantasy could exist in some form, but I think you know, without the support of those leagues, and the other element, of course, is that the bills were actually passed at a state-by-state level. But, you know, it was all kind of a perfect storm where you have fall 2016, New York decides, okay, we're going to pass the daily fantasy bill, and that's what saved them. But really, I think fall 2015, I mean, you know how public opinion can turn, and 2015, they were in terrible shape, and at that point, it was really about them still just having the support of teams and leagues.
New book, Billion Dollar Fantasy, available today. Albert Chen with us. The head-to-head between FanDuel and DraftKings. What are the most interesting, dirtiest details you can give us there? And frankly, Albert, I'm going to need some sex soon. We're going to need some sexy in the, you know, sex, rock and roll, drugs. I want to hear that part of the story soon. But before that, what did the head-to-head look like?
I mean, it was pretty insane. I mean, you know, a lot of people in the industry called DraftKings the suicide bombers. I mean, and because of just the amount of money that they had spent. And, you know, like I have just tons of stories. I'm going to let you down on the sex part because I'm pretty sure none of that is in there. But there are just some moments in boardrooms where just, you know, suddenly a $20 million ad spend goes to $40 million. So the main character, one of the main characters of the story is a woman by the name of Leslie Echols, who is the chief marketing officer for FanDuel. And in the early 2015, when FanDuel thinks they're in great shape, she's on vacation at Harry Potter World, suddenly hearing her phone keeps ringing just from, you know, radio stations, leagues and teams who are saying, okay, well, now we're hearing that DraftKings is going to raise a ton of money. What are you going to do? And so she's essentially being held hostage and signing off on these $20 million, you know, on vacation in Harry Potter World. And she's calling the shots, mother of three in Scotland, who is behind this massive advertising war here in America. It's pretty nuts.
What is her relationship to Nigel, the 43-year-old head of FanDuel? Is she wife, sister? How does that one work?
She's his wife, and they went to it, you know, went all in on this from the beginning. They cleaned out their family savings and put it all into the startup, and it started again as a news prediction site. And, you know, a lot of this is just this weird dynamic that you know, husband and wife and three co-founders around them. She's the wife, and look, she had a very tough position being in this male-dominated arena and really was the secret weapon to FanDuel. The most aggressive of these, you got sort of like these very friendly, genial, and very smart co-founders of FanDuel out in the UK. But she's the killer. 2013, she's the first one to send her co-founders an email. We got to watch out for these DraftKings guys. We got to kill or be killed was really the mentality at this point because they're just trying to survive in this industry.
How is she the killer? Tell me more.
She is just ultra competitive. I mean, you know, I have a book about fantasy sports and gambling, and one key chapter takes place in a scrapbooking club at the University of Edinburgh. And that, you know, I realize that's not going to sell any copies, as I mentioned it here on air, but the anecdote is that she was kicked out of that club because she was taking that competition way too seriously. And so she's got a competitiveness, whether it comes to scrapbooking or a race to become a billion-dollar company. And look, I mean, competitive spirit just in her, but she just felt like she had to prove herself at every turn as a woman, again, in this very male-dominated arena.
Who has got the better chance of success going forward between the two companies?
That's a great question. And I think that is going to become a bigger and bigger question. I think people don't realize the magnitude of the larger landscape because look, gambling is only legal right now in some form, sports gambling in 13 states. So it's still a slow process, but these two companies are very well positioned to be the two biggest gambling companies in America. And it changes every football season who's the front runner. At the end of my book, it was clearly DraftKings. Last football season was huge because it was the first where New Jersey, you can bet on your phone, and DraftKings, shockingly, lost their lead. FanDuel completely took over for a lot of reasons. They've got a sports book at the Meadowlands, and, you know, FanDuel right now is kind of shockingly in the driver's seat. But, yeah, I mean, that keeps changing.
Wrong. The correct answer is DraftKings, a sponsor of the Dan Levitard Show with Stu Gatz. His new book, Billion Dollar Fantasy, is available today.
Albert, is a merger inevitable between these two? Would it strengthen the whole package if they got together?
Well, that was going to be the ending of my book. I mean, you got to talk about a perfect ending, two companies merging. And that was we were all headed towards that. And then the summer of 2017, the FTC blocks this merger because, I mean, for kind of clear reasons, I mean, they would have just completely dominated the market. It's not inevitable. In fact, I think at this point, you're just not going to see it happen. And what's interesting was a big part of that in the early days, and it made sense 5 years ago. But, you know, and I get into it, the culture of the two companies were just so different that it was just so personal that they actually just didn't want to merge and really cooperate for the better of both of them just because of just almost personal reasons. So they're not merging. They're going to go head to head. I think they both see, though, that they can coexist. And, you know, who's number one and who's number two, you know, that remains to be seen. But yeah, these two companies are going to keep going at it as this thing becomes just, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the way, I think this is a key point that not a lot of people realize. New Jersey has surpassed Nevada as the sports betting capital in the country in terms of overall handle. It happened over the summer, kind of changes weekend to weekend. So the play of these two companies in New Jersey is a storyline that is huge, and that's where really the war is taking place in these states where it's now legal and, you know, we can all bet on our phones when we happen to be there vacationing.
Albert, appreciate your time. Thank you for spending it with us.
Did I bring it or was
it was
that?
Brought. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Shipping container, was it brought? No, hey, yeah, shipping brought container, it. Was
yeah,
it brought?
Yeah, dog, you brought it. Brought.
Bringing it.
You brought it almost too hard.
Why cynical Billy? Why is not Billy cynical?
It's too hard. He brought it too hard. Like, I need a break now.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right. I'll take that. I'll take that.
Thank you, Albert.
That was great, guys. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
That was amazing. That's the most incredible interview I've ever heard. I went into it with such low expectations. Albert Chen, FanDuel, DraftKings, give me one fantasy football. Amazing.
What was your favorite part?
Listen, when they were talking about the demise of FanDuel and the rise of DraftKings, amazing. Incredible. Incredible.
You know which one's in much better shape?
DraftKings.
Of course. You know why it's in better shape?
Why?
Because week one is in the books.
Yeah.
But DraftKings isn't finished celebrating with some huge fantasy football contest. For week two of the football season, DraftKings, the leader in one-day fantasy football. See, it says it's the leader right there. So their number one is giving new users a free shot at over $1.5 million in prizes with your first deposit when you put in the code CRATE during sign-up. Draft your lineup and feel the sweat like never before. Every run, every throw, every catch. It just means more with a DraftKings lineup on the line. It's simple. Just draft your lineup, stay under the cap, and see how your team stacks up against the competition. Plus, all new and existing users can get a deposit bonus of up to $500. That's some extra cash to play with this football season. Nothing adds to the sweat of watching a game quite like having a shot at over $1.5 million in prizes. Download the draft. Man, I was doing so well, guys.
So close. You were.
Yeah. I was going to go for 2 for 2. Download the DraftKings app right now and use the code CRATE. For a limited time, both new and existing users can get a deposit bonus of up to $500. New users, don't forget to enter our code CRATE, that's C-R-A-T-E, to get a free shot at over $1.5 million. It's in caps, so I should stress that, right? In prizes with your first deposit. That's code CRATE. Only at DraftKings, minimum $5 deposit required. Deposit bonus requires a 25 times playthrough. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. Fellas, Greg Cody Week continues with another episode of You Never Know. Greg and Chris do an interview. So twice the interview in this week's episode of Mystery Crate. Who do you interview, Chris Cody?
We are talking to a former Marlins bat boy. And I know off the top you hear that and you're like, that's not crazy. But I'm telling you, this guy has really good stories. He was there the season with Joe Girardi and Loria had this big meltdown in the dugout. He tells us about that story. So it's interesting for Marlins fans. It's also interesting just for baseball fans because we ask him just about things that players asked him to do, interactions that he had with Barry Bonds, Albert Pujols. So it's just really interesting if you like baseball.
You never know.
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 You never know. You never know.
You never know.
You never know. You never know.
Today we are talking to a former Marlins bat boy, but he is not just a former Marlins bat boy. He's had a bunch of different interesting jobs in sports, and he's also one of my oldest friends. I went to middle school, high school with this guy. This is Kyle Davis. Kyle, how you doing, buddy?
Good. How you doing?
Do you think I'm good at radio?
No, not at all. I think your dad has taken you along the ride.
Oh, man. We're going to cut that part out. You were a Marlins bat boy for the 2006 season. You worked mainly in the visitor's dugout?
Worked in the visiting side in the clubhouse. So before the games, in the visiting side, after the games, in the visiting side. But during the games, either down the left field line in Marlins uniform or in the Marlins dugout filling in as a bat boy.
So you had one of the coolest gigs, and one of the gigs that I always kind of growing up wanted to have. That was you got to play catch with the left fielder. Was that a scary thing for you? Were you the first time you were doing it? Was that something you were nervous about?
Yeah, at first you get nervous. We started out with the Padres that year, and they were running some jokes on me because they knew I was the new guy. So that was interesting. So you were nervous. But certain players you get nervous for as well.
Who was the left fielder? Like, who was your first throw? Who was the Padres left fielder?
I think it was Will Venable.
Oh, what a name.
What kind of jokes did the Padres pull on you? Like, what do ball players do when they're horsing around?
Well, Trevor Hoffman came to me and was saying he was looking for the bat stretcher. And it's the first, like, hour on the job. And I'm thinking maybe he just meant back. Like, as in, like, stretching your back, like a roller or something.
Right.
He's sending me around to multiple players asking for the bat stretcher. So I'm, like, asking them, is it the bat stretcher or the back stretcher? And I'm asking.
And you're scared because you don't want anyone to get mad at you. So you're just going around. You're like, I don't know what this is. He told me to get a bat stretcher.
Yeah. So I'm asking every player. And all over the Padres team. And then his brother, Glenn Hoffman, was in the dugout, and they wind up sending me to him, and he winds up breaking the news to me. And he's probably like the 10th person I've asked. And he just kind of gives me a big hug and starts laughing at me. And I walk back into the clubhouse, and there's like 8 players just sitting there laughing at me. So it was a good welcoming.
What's your most embarrassing moment as a bad boy? Did you ever like make any big mistakes?
Picking up a fair ball.
Oh, you were down because you're down the left field line. You were the guy that yeah. placed catch. Oh, what happened there?
Todd Green for the Giants, chunky, slow catcher, hit one down the line. Miguel Cabrera, Josh Willingham both thought it was foul. I thought it was foul. The ump called it fair. I picked it up, and then the ump just kind of looked at me like, what the hell are you doing?
Did you do that thing where you then drop it and put your hands up like, what? No, no, no.
I put it right back down on the ground, I walked back to my seat.
Oh, my.
Is that something that, like, after the game, like, someone like David Sampson comes up to you like, excuse me, Kyle, you can't be doing that?
Not Sampson, but I definitely heard about it. I heard about it from the fans. It was like the 4th inning, so I heard about it from the whole 10 fans of the game for the rest of the game. And then when I went back into the locker room, I was kind of reprimanded, saying that stuff can't happen.
Kyle, do bat boys get paid by the team, or is your payment strictly whatever tips players might give you?
Both. You get paid for the games, and then you get tipped out by the players. So that's always the unknown. Some players are awesome. Some players just walk right past you. But on getaway day, normally like we'll clean cleats or stuff like that in the back. On getaway day, we're right up front, like sitting there like a homeless person waiting for the tips.
That's got to be crazy because there's so many dudes on a baseball team. Like everyone's tipping you out or like just guys that you like helped with?
Yeah, well, everyone has to tip out the clubhouse manager. They have a minimum that they have to tip them, and some give a lot more. And then players, like if you help them out, if you did something for them, or if you just talk to them, they'll remember you, and they kind of tip you out.
What's the most generous tip you ever got from a player where he handed you the money and you're thinking to yourself, whoa?
I think it was for doing absolutely nothing, basically. Lasting's Millage on the Mets.
These random names you're dropping on.
Random people. Oh, yeah. So that's when they had like PSPs, and he wanted the new Madden game. And they got that Walmart across the street from Dolphin Stadium. So I ran over there, grabbed it, came back, and he gave me a $150 tip.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, I mean, you could have just got this for yourself and saved $150, but I got $150 for spent 10 minutes going across the street.
And opposite of his generosity, is there a player, and name him or don't, is there a player who like was the biggest jerk, who was just like a guy that you dreaded even being in the same vicinity of?
There were some jerks. I mean, I think going through the in and outs of the day, you don't know what's going on in their life, but I think Pujols was a jerk. The Marlins front office always wanted stuff signed, and they always brought stuff to visiting locker rooms so that you can get it signed. And I brought it over to Pujols and put it in his locker and some balls and some bats and asking if you can get these signed that Sampson wants to get them signed. They used them for charity. And Pujols yelled, I don't want to sign this shit. They always want me signing shit, and kind of threw some stuff around, and I'm just the messenger, right, but I got the brunt of all of it. And he wasn't the nicest guy. I think the Cardinals in general, I think they were kind of in a slump, but it was just a weird clubhouse. They obviously knew how to win, but if they lost, it was like a funeral in there. We had to come through the back side of the clubhouse to get in. We couldn't walk through after a loss.
That was in the La Russa days, right?
Yeah, that was in the La Russa days. So it was a much more serious clubhouse than what people would expect.
What's the oddest errand a player ever sent you on?
There's all sorts of errands that they have you do. Big Poppy had a house in Weston, so he drove his Hummer into the stadium, and they had a back room kind of where the cheerleaders shared like a stretching room as well, where they sold Louis Vuitton and all the like high-end like shoes and purses and luggage and wallets and all that kind of stuff. And I remember him asking me to go out to his car and grab some more cash out of his car so that he can just buy some Louis Vuitton stuff, and in 30 minutes wasted many thousands of dollars on Louis Vuitton for no reason. So, I mean, just watching that kind of money.
And he's just like, trusting you. Like, not that you're untrustworthy, but just like some random guy. Hey, go out to my car and grab all this cash and bring it back and don't do anything with it.
Yeah. I mean, they throw money around like it's nothing.
Did a player ever slip you a piece of paper with his phone number and say, hey, bring it to that beautiful woman in the third row there with the low-cut blouse?
many times. I don't know how good that is to say, but I mean, the girls come at them just as much as they go at them. So, I mean, there's been some interesting situations where like, hey, make sure you get this girl out of from the stands or find that girl. Or there was a certain player at a certain time in the middle of a game during a pitching change came over to me and was like, I need that girl's phone number.
You were there in 2006 was the Joe Girardi season. So you were with the team. And there's this story that David Sampson has talked about on the show with us where Girardi was like essentially fired in the middle of a game for yelling at Loria and but then like not ever actually fired. They like changed their mind. Like, were you there for that? What's your take on that story?
I was bat boying that day in the Marlins dugout. So I was right in the middle of Loria and Gary Tuck and Joe Girardi.
So you literally had like a front row seat to this story.
Yeah, they were yelling over my head back and forth.
What was Girardi yelling?
Well, I think it was pretty sure it was a day game, and the ump was just horrible. There was not a call that was going our way, and everything was being squeezed or vice versa, wide open when we were at the plate. And in the middle of the inning, Loria, for some unknown reason, decides to stand up to the screen in those seats down at home plate and start screaming at the ump, calling him by his first name and like trying to get his attention to yell at him. And the ump's not really giving him the time of day, but kind of giving him that side eye, like, why are you even talking to me? And Girardi had every right to tell him to shut up. But he told him, Jeffrey, you need to shut up. We already have enough problems this game. And there was probably some curse words in there at that time, too. Loria turned around and he says, that's the way you talk to your boss. And Gary Tuck started kind of blowing up on him.
Who's Gary Tuck?
He was the bench coach at the time. He wound up being like a Yankees bullpen coach as well under Girardi when he went over there.
Tuck was kind of playing like the middleman.
Yeah, and but Girardi was young. He kind of threw his Gatorade bottle and was kind of pissed off. And Loria kind of acted a little immature in the sense because, I mean, as an adult, you can understand that Girardi's just trying to do his job and we don't need someone else affecting the situation to make it worse. But they were kind of yelling back and forth at each other. And he's like, oh, okay, we'll see about that. See how you talk to your boss like that. That's not how this works around here. He goes upstairs, tells Samson, I want him gone. Samson comes running down. He comes through the seats and asks the security guard who's sitting right behind me what he heard and kind of gives this, like, death stare into the dugout at Girardi.
Samson does.
Yeah. And Girardi's just sitting there like, hey, what are you going to do? And so Samson goes back into the clubhouse. They're planning on doing the firing. They even set up a press conference room and got it ready to announce a firing. And then the players, like they, after the game, I think Warriors waiting in Girardi's office and they had the talk of that. And I think the players found out and they were like, we're not playing or we want nothing to do with this. So I think Girardi had to apologize to Loria in front of the team. And Girardi knew from then on out he was done at the end of the year. I mean, Bobby Meacham, they all knew. But, I mean, Girardi was as professional as can be at all times.
But the team kind of had Girardi's back, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, crap, they were a bunch of rookies, and they were on fire that year. I mean, he won manager of the year and got fired. I mean, they had Freddy Gonzalez hired before basically he got fired.
Yeah. What's the best prank you witnessed players, like, on each other? Was that a thing that was big in clubhouses?
I mean, it's tough on the visiting side. Players messed with me down the line. Like, they involve more than just the players. Like, they involve, like, the bullpen cleaning guys. And they're sitting there, the bullpen cleaning guys are talking to me, and one of the pitchers was putting bubble gum, big bubble on my head. And it sat there for an inning. I had no idea until I took my helmet off to go play catch and realized I had gum on my head for a whole inning.
What's the coolest moment that you witnessed, just in terms of, you know, historically? Like, if my memory serves me right, wasn't 06 when Anibal Sanchez's no-hitter was?
Yeah, and I was bat-boying again for that one. So I got that photo on my wall at my house is the day of Bat Boy for Annabelle's no-hitter. But
so do Bat Boys, when after a game, when like they all pile on the field, like, are you part of that?
I didn't know what the hell to do. I was in shock. I mean, it was late in the game, and I don't think anyone realized we had a no-hitter till about like the sixth inning. Miguel Olivo was coming up on bat, and he looks up, and he goes, oh, shit, there's no-hitter. And he's catching it. It was a surreal moment because, you know, I mean, as a kid, you imagine that and wanting to be a part of it and then just being like right there with everything. It was pretty cool.
Being a Major League Bat Boy and clubhouse guy, I mean, that's a dream job to a lot of young kids. What was a moment where you just looked around and said, man, I'm so lucky to be doing this?
There's plenty of those. But when you see people, more in the clubhouse, I would think, because these are people you grew up watching, and you see, like, Barry Bonds or Bob Uecker, like a big players, Frank Robinson coming in, and like there are people like your parents talk to you about as a kid, and like you see them, and then you're just hanging out with them, and you're in the kitchen, you're eating with them. Bonds was a lot better than I expected. I always thought he'd be like the jerk, and he was a lot nicer.
Did you have any like interactions with him?
Yeah, I think it was back when he was going through all that drama and PED stuff and whatnot, and him and I were the only ones in the locker room watching his interview with Bob Costas, and it was an interesting time. It got a little emotional in there, and I remember after, like, we went out into the hallway, and him and I sat together on the golf cart and just talked for like 10 minutes outside the locker room on the golf cart, and he was an awesome guy. Like, I respected him much more, but going into it, I didn't expect it, and then it was like when certain people walk in the locker room, you're like, you're told by the guys who've been there forever, hey, kind of stay away from this guy or kind of stay away from that guy. And then, you know, like other players walk in, they've seen these guys all the time and they're high-fiving and whatnot. But Bonds was always one of those guys, like, maybe you stay away from, but he was really nice to me.
When you were playing catch with guys in left field, was there ever one particular guy that would get upset if you weren't hitting him like directly in the chest every time?
Cliff Floyd. We just didn't get along.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think I wasn't throwing that great that day. Like, my arm was kind of sore. And he doesn't throw that great to begin with.
So you guys are just all over the place?
Yeah, I think I short hopped him once, and then the next throw he threw, he put it over my head about 5 feet, and he's yelling at me, why can't I jump? And I'm like, oh, not the most fleet of foot. I'm not going to be able to jump that high. Plus, it hit the back wall of the bullpen. I can't catch that. So he got kind of pissed off, and like I threw the next one to him, kind of pissed off back to him, and next one in, he just rolled back to me, and I just left it on the ground and let one of the bullpen people pick it up. I was like, I'm not falling for that crap.
Wow, no tip from Cliff Floyd that day, huh?
No, I did not get a tip from Cliff Floyd that one.
2006, I'm feeling so old now, Bobby Cox was still the manager of the Braves, right? Did you have any, like, interactions with him? He always seemed interesting.
Yeah, he was one of those people, like Bonds, I expected to be kind of hard-nosed and wouldn't give you the time of day, but he was asking for a cup of coffee, and
Bobby Cox drinks his coffee black.
I'm pretty sure it was just straight black. And he asked for a cup of coffee, and he's like, oh, I'll be out in the bullpen. So I grabbed his coffee, and I took it out to the bullpen, and it was just him out there, and he's sitting under that blue railing that used to be out there, and because it's drizzling and raining a little bit. And I gave him the coffee, and he's getting his cigar going, and he said, hey, just want to sit around here and talk. So I sat there for about 10 minutes or so and talked with Bobby Cox, and it was a cool experience to be with him and listen to the stories he had as well. He got a lot of stories through the years, or through the people you meet, like Jamie Moyer at that time. What was he, like 105 pitching?
Right.
And he's like, oh, this is my last year pitching. I think he pitched like 8 years after that.
That's funny. I imagine Bobby Cox the entire time is just bitching about Andrew Jones not running out stuff.
Yeah. He wouldn't throw anyone under the bus.
Hey, Kyle, man, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate the good stuff.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
That was amazing, man. I mean, a bat boy. Who can make a bat boy interesting? I went into it with such low expectations, and Greg and Chris, they killed it. But the star of the show is the bat boy. And that story told about Bonds, incredible. Incredible.
What was your favorite part?
The Bonds story. And the pool host. That part.
You didn't listen, though.
Albert.
Yeah. You plan on listening?
Yeah, he heard it.
Nope.
We want to thank Sugats for being a part of this week's Mystery Crate. Be sure to check out his wonderful podcast. What's it called?
Stupidity!
And he hasn't taken a week off. There are weeks that the Mystery Crate are off because we're trying to space these things out. I'm sure the time is coming where you're just going to rattle off a bunch of off weeks. But in the meantime, Sugats is there for you every week doing the most original show on the Levitard and Friends Network.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm going to quit if I don't get paid. That's it. That's my height. Otherwise, I keep coming back for more. Why? Why am I doing it?
I don't know. Stupidity.